The stories of genocide or slavery are often passed down through families. They serve as reminders or evidence, and they can have a profound effect on the way relationships and bonds are shaped. But more and more research is revealing that this isn't just an oral tradition, that trauma is also passed down through a family's genes. The neuroscientist Brian Diaz told us this week about an experiment he and colleagues conducted in 2013 at the Emory University School of Medicine. It was a mice study. It was pretty extensive, and I'm going to oversimplify it here, but here's the gist of it for our purposes. They gave a male mouse a mild shock when it smelled a scent. One of them was a cherry blossom. And it turned out the reaction to that scent, that response of being shocked, was passed along. Two generations. Now remember, these were male mice, and somehow the impact of that experience was transmitted biologically. Here's Brian Diaz.
I think it's important to understand that as a society, we've always grappled with whether our identity as individuals, as communities, as societies, emanates from nature, the genes that we are born with, or nurture, the environments that we experience. We now know that that nature-nurture dichotomy is indeed false. It's not so much a dichotomy, but so much an amalgamation of nature and nurture that allows us to develop an identity at the individual level, at the community level, at the societal level. And we want to understand how this occurs. How does nature and nurture interact? How does the environment interact with our genes to allow for not only the generation that's directly exposed to a stressor, influenced by that stressor, but also how our future generations who might not directly experience that trauma or stress, how do they bear the imprints of that ancestral trauma? To understand these questions, we use reductionistic models in the laboratory, and a lot of colleagues across the world have done really powerful work which demonstrates across different species, using flies, using worms, using rodents, that stressors in one generation influence future generations. But the stressors that were used, as powerful as they were of a broad nature. And the question that arose was, how do you tag a stressor in one generation? Or can you tag a stress in one generation and then follow that stress and visualize the imprints of that stress across generations? So what we did was we took male mice and we exposed them to what's called olfactory fear conditioning. That is, we made a particular smell aversive to those mice. So we've tagged a stressor by making a smell aversive. So that tag is the smell. And then using the power of genetics and behavioral neuroscience, we can then ask, how does the offspring of those mice that are now scared of a particular smell or odor, how do those offspring behave when they themselves experience that odor, smell that odor, and how do their brains develop in the parts of the brain where that odor is processed? And what we found is that offspring born to male mice who've been conditioned to be afraid of a particular smell have a behavioral sensitivity to that smell, even though they've never smelled that odor before. And their brain devotes more real estate towards processing that smell. And we think this is really important because what it's allowing the nervous system of the future generation to do is it's priming the nervous system to respond to the smell in a particular way, such that it will either help them navigate their own environment when they smell that odor in their environments, or it'll be to the detriment of that particular next generation. What was also striking is we found that the germline, in this case the sperm of the male mice who had been made fearful to this particular odor, their sperm bore imprints of this particular experience such that the sperm registered at the level of the genome that there was a particular experience with this odor. And we think that that's how there's a mechanism by which one generation can hand the baton of a stressor or a trauma to future generations. Now, work since that study, and a lot of other colleagues have done, again, really important work in this arena, we're now gaining an appreciation that sperm contain really small molecules called RNA. And those RNA act as puppeteers in the embryo to now interact with the genome to allow for certain genes to be expressed or not. And that's how we think legacies of trauma, legacies of stress, legacies of experiences get passed on from one generation to the next.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Brian Diaz is joining us to talk about the science of intergenerational trauma, but also how you can use this knowledge to create what he describes as legacies of empathy. Diaz is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California.
This journey to understand how legacies of stress and trauma perpetuate across generations, reverberate across generations, echo across generations, is a deeply personal one to me. I was physically abused when I was a child, and now as a parent, I fight every single day to not perpetuate the legacies of that stress and trauma to my own children. And then I also grew up in India at a time where I vividly remember the bombings and the riots that stem from communal tensions between the Hindu majority and the Muslim minority. And the societal implications of that and the reverberations of those tensions across several generations was not lost on me. And so putting those two pieces together, my personal history as well as the society that I grew up in, I think I'm fundamentally driven to really understand how do legacies of stress echo across generations and what can we do to stop them.
At what point in your life did it occur to you that science would be the way to figure that out, to resolve that? Was that always something that you realized, or did that come to you?
As we say in science, and as I say every day to everyone that I work with and my colleagues who are in this field, I stand on the shoulders of giants. There were colleagues who were doing really important work before I started this work, and I'm indebted to them for the research that they have done over the years to shed light on how legacies of stress echo across generations. And I see my work as building on that. And from there, the realization that if one can be reductionistic about it, but also see the forest from the trees, one has the ability to shed light on both how legacies of stress echo across generations, but also what we can do to halt those legacies.
Can you give us an example of, we'll dig into some more particulars as we go, how it's transmitted. But generally speaking, this legacy of trauma echoing across generations, there are a few examples you've talked about. I'm not sure which one you want to sort of tease out here, but the story of Romanian children is compelling. Of course, the effects of the Holocaust as well. Maybe use one of those as a way of explaining what we mean, just broadly speaking.
In thinking about how legacies of stress or trauma echo across generations, there are three real ways by which we are thinking that they do so. One is how someone is affected by a particular stressor or trauma affects how that someone will now go on to parent or interact with their own offspring, thereby perpetuating those legacies. Two, if the stressor or the trauma is experienced while pregnant, the fetus then, even though it's cozying up in mom's uterus, is going to bear the legacies of that stressor that's swirling around it. And then the last way by which we think legacies of stress and trauma echo across generations is that sperm and egg come to bear imprints of these stressors and trauma, such that now when you have the union of sperm and egg, and you have this embryo that is going to develop into the multicellular you and I, that embryo then develops with a legacy of stress. In thinking about these possibilities, the social transmission of information is a really powerful way by which legacies of stress echo across generations. At the fall of the Ceausescu regime in Romania, there were children who were put into orphanages, and those orphanages had really dismal conditions in terms of care, in terms of resources, and those children were neglected, and they didn't have the best start to life. What data show from those studies is that stressors really early in life have the potential to sculpt behavior, to sculpt emotional regulation, to sculpt physiology, and that sets one down the road then for those legacies perpetuating across generations, because now those children go on to interact with their communities in a certain way, and that's how you have the ripple effects of stress. If we were to think about the in utero scenario, let's take, for example, being born in an environment which has a really high chemical load. So let's take redlining in the United States, for example, where there are communities that were developed in really low-lying areas where there's a lot of industry that's built, there's a lot of chemical pollutants, as a result of which the individuals who might have been in utero at the time when mum was experiencing these particular chemical insults, those chemical insults then are transferred to the fetus, and that affects brain development. That affects the development of brain regions that might be involved in parental behavior, might be involved in aggression, and as a result of which, when that fetus grows up, it's born with a legacy of that chemical insult, and that's how that legacy of the chemical insult will perpetuate across generations. That legacy of redlining will perpetuate across generations.
It's interesting, when you have talked about the effects of social transmission, for example, and I wonder if this applies in other ways. You say that, for example, you've mentioned some rat studies you did, and the sort of grooming behavior of rat mothers and the effect it has on their babies, on their pups. And you say if a pup gets high-quality care from its mother, it passes that on. But if it gets, you know, low quality or it gets neglected, it passes that along as well. Talk a little bit about that. Why would it – I guess what's in the evolutionary interest of a pup passing along eventually bad behavior that doesn't make another creature thrive? Like, what? How does it work in that way, if that makes sense?
The studies that you're talking about were started by Michael Meaney and colleagues in the early 2000s. And they're a really powerful framework within which we see evolution in action. Mm-hmm. What Professor Meany and his colleagues did was they leveraged naturally occurring variation in maternal care in rats. And as you alluded to, what they found is that a rat pup who experienced high quality maternal care went on to bestow high quality care to its own pups. Whereas a rat pup that experienced low quality maternal care, and it's called low level licking, grooming, and arch-back nursing, that rat pup now would go on to bestow low quality care to its own offspring. And that, I think, is a perfect example of how evolution works. Evolution needs some variation within which to act. And as a result of which, the high quality care perpetuates across generations, the low quality care perpetuates across generations, and you have a melding of the two that would allow over several generations for different motifs of those care to be selected for. Now, it's interesting that you bring up that particular study, because what we're also appreciating now is that it's not all gloom and doom. Legacies of trauma and stress don't always confer detrimental consequences to the offspring. We are now appreciating through animal studies, but also in the human literature, that there might be scenarios wherein there are detrimental consequences of being born with a legacy of trauma or stress, but there are also a trade-off, because there are also some positive consequences that allow for behavioral flexibility to become embodied in the next generation that allows for them to actually thrive despite that legacy of stress. We don't know what allows for that trade-off to happen, but I want us to realize that it's not all gloom and doom, and there are silver linings which we need to hold on to if we are to reverse and halt these legacies of stress and trauma.
Brian Diaz, he's an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. He studies stress and trauma. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Listeners can hear KUER on the radio across Utah. Beyond the dial, there are many ways to stay connected to NPR Utah. Enjoy our free live stream at KUER.org. Take us wherever you go with the KUER mobile app. And if you have a smart speaker, find us there, too, by saying play KUER. Explore all the ways to stay connected at KUER.org/listen.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about, I guess, the mechanics of intergenerational trauma, because the effects of abuse aren't abstract. A growing body of research is showing that trauma can be passed from one generation to another. Our guest, the neuroscientist Brian Diaz, says racism or bullying or even a lack of resources can find its way into your genes, passed through eggs and sperm, to where you have an actual embryo that develops with this legacy of stress. But knowing this, he says, can help us build a new pathway of kindness and compassion. We'll come back to this, but this is one of the things you've talked about, is that we have a capacity in, I guess, changing our behavior, changing these legacies to in a very literal and actual way, go in and do some editing on the DNA. Is that reductive? Is that right to say that?
So when we think about how these legacies of stress echo across generations, one of the ways by which this happens is that the environment really interacts intricately with our genome, with our DNA. And the way it does that is, if you think of our DNA like a book is read, but a book is read and the meaning of that book is read one way if page 2 is completely redacted and page 3 has highlights versus whiteouts, compared to a book where page 2 is not redacted and other components of page 3 have highlights and not whiteouts. And so what the environment does is it's recruiting molecular editors in our biology that allow for our DNA to be marked with the equivalent of full stops and commas and highlights and whiteouts, such that you and I may experience the same event, but in my book of life, page 2 comes to be redacted, whereas in your book of life, page 2 is not, by that same environmental event, as a result of which the book is read differently in you and I, that allows for you and I to have vastly different outcomes. And so that's one way by which genes and environment interact with each other to allow us to bear witness to the legacy of stress and trauma. Now, if we were to get a little more molecular about it, a stressor or a trauma influences the individual that's directly experiencing it and results in a chemical storm of stress hormones, a chemical storm of immune signals. That in turn goes and acts on specific cells. That interaction with these cells puts the equivalent of the whiteouts and the commas and the full stops on these cells that then allows for a cell to experience what we call epigenetic aging, where the aging could be accelerated or it could be decelerated. And when that aging is accelerated or decelerated, that brain development or that heart development or that lung development might actually be accelerated or decelerated. And that comes at a price. You don't want to accelerate aging because everything occurs with normative trajectories of development. You close things too soon, you age too fast, and you don't allow enough maturity for the nervous system to develop. And that comes with its own attendant challenges. So in thinking about how these legacies of stress echo across generations, I want us to keep three things in mind: the chemical storm, epigenetic aging, and brain development. And when we think about all of those three together, we can see not only how the individual who's directly in the line of attack of a particular stress or trauma is affected, but also future generations, depending on when they're exposed to that particular stressor or trauma.
It seems, maybe this is the reason it's been difficult to talk about this, to really understand the implications of what you're saying, is it seems really difficult to tease out the various influences here. The physiological one, you know, influence seems to be so tangled up with the sociological, this idea of epigenetics, the as you said, the false binary of nature versus nurture. And I'm wondering if you see that as an obstacle to having this conversation, that we have to understand these things all work together. And I wonder if that's part of the conversation that you have with people in getting us to understand all of this.
If our North Star is to be halting legacies of trauma and stress in their track, it matters very little whether the genesis of that is in our genes or whether that's tangled up in our sociology.
Yeah, yeah.
What matters so much is, what do we do about it?
Right.
Yes, biologically and for scientists, we'd like to solve these puzzles of nature and understand how the pieces of the jigsaw, the gene piece versus the environmental piece, the the sociological piece fall together. They're intricately linked, just like pieces of a jigsaw are. But to be able to halt these legacies, I feel like we need to move beyond that. And what we need to do is we need to take a bird's eye view of that jigsaw puzzle, identify where interventions could be applied to really reshape how we interpret that jigsaw puzzle, and in that interpretation allows the promise for us to halt these legacies of stress and trauma.
What does that look like then, that process of halting it? And how many generations, I hate to keep coming back to that, but how many generations does it take to get this out of a system? And does that, or does that matter? Because how do you fix this? How do you end it? And then how long does it take to work its way out of a system? And one of the things you've talked about, for example, is the effect on these children in Romania who are deprived of love and care in the early part of their lives. They experienced stunted growth. They experienced this neural pathway disruption, among other things. Like, how do you fix that? Isn't something like that permanent damage? Or can, even in the process of the people who have experienced it, that first generation, can that be repaired in some way? I don't know. Does that make sense as a question?
If you remember, I talked about how legacies of stress and trauma echo across generations through the chemical storm of stress hormones and immune signaling, epigenetic aging that's accelerated versus decelerated, and then the attendant consequences on brain development.
Right.
Each of those has a malleability to them. The die is not cast. So you could have societal interventions, policies that would allow for the chemical storm to abate. You could allow for social interventions to slow down accelerated epigenetic aging or hasten decelerated aging that might be happening. And you could have policies in place that influence brain development. Now, we're not there just yet in terms of understanding how this will be. We don't understand the precision by which this could occur. But the fact that all of these have a malleability to it indicates to us that that die is not cast. One also needs to be respectful of the fact that depending on who you talk to, some people want to forget and other people do not. And it's not for us to decide what is remembered versus what is not. In several ways, biology does not let us forget because it's biologically advantageous to hold on to that memory so that we can be self-preservative for ourselves, but also then preserve the communities and the societies that we live in. And so all that our societal interventions can do is they can mask what the biological consequences of those atrocities were. And the way we mask those is we are intentional and consistent in the societal interventions and policies that we put into place. In thinking about how we can halt legacies of stress and trauma from echoing across generations, I want us to keep acknowledging biomarkers and community in mind, A, B, and C. It starts with acknowledging that legacies of atrocities exist and continue to do so. Once we acknowledge that these legacies are rooted deeply, we need to identify individuals who might be at risk to bear these legacies. And the way we do that is we profile biomarkers that will allow us with some confidence to say that an individual who's at risk for bearing a legacy will bear this particular biological signature of maybe brain activity, of maybe epigenetic aging, of RNA signatures in the blood. And what this allows us to do is it allows us to give voice, biological voice, to all those who have been the recipients of legacies of trauma, because it tells them that it's no longer in their head. There's a physical manifestation of this. There's a biological manifestation of this. Their biology remembers those atrocities. And then we come to C, which is the most important, which is community. Our ability to halt these legacies starts and ends with community. I'd be happy to be proven wrong, but I don't think the strategy to halt these legacies is going to be found in an open drug label bottle. It's going to be community where all of us band together. We have societal interventions and policies that are intentional and that are consistent. We put our foot on the accelerator 24/7, 365 days of the year, and in not letting up lies our ability to mask those legacies of trauma, which, remember, are not forgotten, and they're not forgotten for a reason.
So I wanted to key on the effects of all of this on two different populations in this country, the descendants of enslaved people from Africa and indigenous people forced off their ancestral land, thousands of their children forced into boarding schools. Let's talk about the indigenous example for a moment first, and maybe some of the work that you've been thinking about or doing with on this subject. Do you have a particular intervention in mind? You talked about it being – it's important to be intentional and consistent related to those trying to heal from the extraordinary trauma of indigenous boarding schools. Is it a conversation you have in mind? Is it a kind of a truth and reconciliation sort of process? Or do you have something in mind there?
Colleagues have been working with indigenous populations for many years. And again, it boils down to A, B, and C. First, acknowledging that there were atrocities that were committed. And so this would be about the truth and reconciliation part that you talked about. But then we need to understand how those individuals are affected, which is where the biomarkers come in. And so we need to understand how the biology responded to those atrocities. And then you put in community-level interventions, be that counseling for substance abuse, if that is prevalent in the community. Or you have mentorship programs for the children as they rise to the ranks of their academic ladders, and determine the efficacy of those community interventions, not only by behavioral indices, but also the physiological indices, the biomarkers that you that were in the front line of those atrocities to begin with. And that's how we begin to heal the wounds and halt these legacies of trauma.
Brian Diaz is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Keck School of Medicine of USC. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Weekends on KUER are filled with the same high-quality news and engaging conversations you hear every weekday. Have a laugh and test your news knowledge with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Find your guide to culture and connect to creators with Bullseye. Or hear the week's latest music on All Songs Considered. The best in NPR news and entertainment awaits you this weekend on KUER. See what's in store at KUER.org/schedule.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the wake of the stories about the U.S. government forcing thousands of Native American children into boarding schools, we've been wanting to understand how you measure the impact of that experience. And a growing body of research is showing that trauma can be passed from one generation to another. Our guest, the neuroscientist Brian Diaz, told us that if we're going to heal these wounds, it's important to understand this is biology. It's our bodies and brains, he says, that bear and pass along these scars. There's a metaphor you've talked about before. It's one that relates to the sort of the epigenetic landscape called Waddington's landscape. It's a visual metaphor you've referred to. Could you maybe take us through that? I found that interesting and hopeful, I think.
Waddington's landscape refers to visually a ball on a hill, and that ball could roll down different parts of that hill, the different bumps and the valleys, and it's going to hit a rock here, and it's going to hit some grass over there. And depending on how that ball rolls down, it's going to land in very different places. And so if you think of that ball as a cell in your brain, if you think of that ball as a cell in my heart, if you think of that ball as an embryo that is ripe to become the person that you and I have become, as sperm and egg are on top of that hill, they've formed a union, and that embryo is now rolling down. That embryo now, that cell in my brain, that cell in your heart, all of those are going to accrue their environmental experiences and be jostled one way versus another, and they're going to land on different parts on the ground, and as a result of which, my brain cell is going to have a different outcome than your brain cell. Your heart cell is going to have a different outcome than my heart. And that embryo that was rolling down the hill is going to have vastly differing outcomes if it lands on the right side, where it experienced tranquility as it was in utero, or whether it experienced the squall of domestic abuse while in utero. And depending on those experiences, you're going to have an individual then who has borne a legacy of serenity and calm, or calamity and strife in varying ways.
It makes me think about how we define our terms when we're talking about racism, because this is something you've mentioned, that there's a physical component to racism, bullying and abuse. Physiological is the bullying part, just even having access to resources, being, receiving sort of skepticism or being gaslit, by critics. All of those components come into play. I wanted you to talk a little bit about that, because the idea of racism is far more complicated, I think, in that sense.
I completely agree that racism has far-reaching legacies that we're only now coming to appreciate. But I'm going to take a step back and talk about discrimination in general, because that discrimination could happen based on a variety of factors. And when we think about that discrimination, it comes at the expense of access to resources. It comes at the expense of safe environments where there's a lot of violence, for example, sometimes. It comes at the expense of, as we talked about earlier, comes at the expense of being born into a community which has a high chemical pollutant in its environment. It comes at the cost of being born in geographical locales that are in the flight paths of airplanes, which are dumping a bunch of lead fuel on you over time. all of those forms of discrimination eventually boil down into our physiology, eventually are registered by our biology. And so no matter what you're talking about, whether it's racism more specifically, whether it's discrimination more generally, all of these atrocities, and they are atrocities, interface with our biology and get embedded under our skin and make us bear witness to that atrocity, but also have far-reaching consequences for our offspring and our grand offspring.
I wonder, Doctor, if you think that when you talk about how important it is to filter this through community, to have these conversations about interventions, about biomarkers, doesn't that presume a kind of healthy community that is willing to have these conversations back and forth, give and take? And I wonder if you think, if you're just reflecting on the condition of I'll just say American community right now, the hyper-partisanship. And I wonder if that worries you. Are we in a position to have these kinds of conversations about community right now? Don't we have to work out some important elements of our relationships right now?
We have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. Right. We have to work on those relationships with our neighbors, with our within our community. But then we also have to see the forest from the trees and work in our communities, build that trust amongst the community that we have each other's backs, which is why it's so important for us scientists to step out of our academic circles and talk about how our work matters, because we need to build that trust. People need to understand that we are humans first and scientists second. And we are doing this work to understand ourselves as much as to understand the phenomena of intergenerational legacies of trauma. And so I refuse to yield to the pessimism that comes from the hyper-partisanship that we currently live in. We have to be able to think global and act local. And in that thinking globally, where we want to live in a world that is utopia, whatever utopia means, for ourselves as well as our children and our grandchildren, we do that at the local level by volunteering, by breaking bread with someone who we don't necessarily get along with. And I think if we can do that and divorce ourselves from the outcomes of those conversations, I think we have the potential to really make some changes in how society functions. Too often, we start off conversations with wanting to say, I'm right and you're wrong. And this is where I'll take a page from my Tibetan Buddhist scholars who I have the privilege of teaching neuroscience to every summer in monasteries in India. They learn via a debating tradition, but unlike our debates, which are let me be right and you be wrong, their debates start off with a mantra which says, let's move closer to the truth. They're not seeking to convince anyone. They put out their point and then they divorce themselves from the outcome. If the other person comes to thinking how you think, that's great, but that's not the goal. The goal is to bond over the frailties and celebration of being human and move forward as a society in as best a way as possible.
What's left that you want to understand about all of this? Do you think you have a good grasp of it now, or as you're thinking about the, you know, experiments you're working out, is there something left that you wish you could figure out, had a better understanding of? And what is your work like these days in that sense?
Well, we're really interested in understanding at this point in time is how does an embryo that bears a legacy of stress develop with that legacy such that you have vastly differing outcomes in adulthood if you've had a legacy of strife and calamity growing up versus if you had a legacy of serenity and calm as the embryo was developing. There's a lot that happens from going from one cell to the trillions of cells that make up you and I. And so we need to march along from a biological perspective to catalog and profile how those legacies of stress are registered in the different organ systems of the body, in the different tissues of the body. Because in that biology, we then come to appreciate, for example, why is it that certain communities might have a higher incidence, for example, of cardiovascular disease while others don't? Maybe it's because as the embryo was developing, the cells that go on to develop the heart develop in a particular way, which is not the way that they develop when that embryo develops with a legacy of serenity and calm. So that's one of the things that is keeping us awake at night. And then broadly speaking, societally, it's how do you halt these legacies using community-based interventions? What are the motifs of those community-based interventions that are the strongest predictors of halting these legacies? But fundamentally, it's about acknowledging that these legacies have occurred. It's about building trust in the communities that we want to understand how they occur with the intent of wanting to halt them. Those are some of the things that are our North Star at this point.
I'll come back to this question, and it may, given how complicated this is, that may be a reductive sort of, maybe it's too overly simplistic, I suppose. But I did want to come back to the question of just how many generations does it take to get this out of the system? Is there a simple answer to that?
Earlier, we talked about how it's not in the best interest of the individual in the direct line of an atrocity or its offspring to actually forget that that atrocity happened.
Right.
And so then the question about how many generations would it take for this memory of this atrocity, and by memory I use it loosely, I'm talking about how the biological memory of this atrocity perpetuates and persists across generations. The answer to that question is, it is probably going to persist in perpetuity. All that we can do is to diminish the hold that that memory has on our psychology, on our physiology, and on our being. Which is why it's also so important for our societal interventions to be intentional and consistent. Because if it's not, and we slip up, the potential for those marks of trauma to resurface always exists. Because remember, we've masked them. We haven't erased them.
So that really puts the responsibility on us, right? On the community. We've got to find these interventions and that we have to be, as you said, I think you put it that way, we have to be consistent, because we're not going to just wake up one day and these things are going to be gone. We have to be vigilant, I guess, is the answer.
Absolutely. And I think it boils down to three things which can get encompassed into all of the programs that already exist with this intent of halting these legacies of trauma from echoing across generations. It starts out by forming a sense of community. There's communication amongst that community, and there's collaboration, all with the goal of halting these legacies. And when we can work as a collective, but we first need to acknowledge what those legacies are. But after we do that, if we can work as a collective, we can be a strong community. We can collaborate as a community. We can communicate as a community. That's where the richness of being able to halt these legacies lies, and the promise to halt these legacies lies.
Brian Diaz, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for this important conversation.
Brian Diaz, he studies trauma and stress. He's an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. The program is produced by Carrie Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. Stephanie Allerton is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.